you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have John Q. Publius on the show. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How about you?
Very well, thank you. So, John, I'm gathering that that's sort of a pen name or a.
Yeah. Well, you know how it is in these interesting times.
Well, you know if. Hamilton, John Jay, and Madison used that strategy for the Federalist Papers. So why can't we, right?
Right, exactly. They'd
already won. So
hey, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, yeah. I took that and then I just smushed it together with John Q. Public. So
yeah,
I did
yeah,
kind
yeah,
of yeah, amalgam.
I figured to think of John Q. Public. So Okay. Well, today I wanted to discuss a series of articles you've been writing on your website. The uniquely named the anatomically correct banana. it's the way life should be series. But before we get into that, and I'll let you really get in, how much detail you want to get into that and invite people to read those articles. I think you're up to 10 now. And I just actually just started reading the 10th one as leading into this interview. The anatomically correct banana, what's the purpose of that website? And also, you also host a podcast, correct?
Yeah, so the podcast is The Cocktail Hour, and anyone can find it on Spreaker if they so choose. And the website, I would say, I've always published in article format. I've tried to keep it fairly formal and not treat it as like a sort of journaling blog. But I opened it up to outside submissions a couple months ago, and I've had some really, really good stuff. So it's kind of a platform for lots of different dissident voices to come on and publish material about anything from religion to politics to, you know, social things. And I have fairly minimal editorial interference. I kind of, even if I'm not 100% on board with a concept, I like to give people the opportunity to get on there and voice their ideas and be able to contribute to the conversation. But from my end, I kind of get on kicks where I become more interested in some aspect of something or other, and then I just follow it until I'm either interested in something else or something kind of comes across my radar. So I saw something maybe it was late June, somewhere around there. And all of a sudden, like magic, there were several hundred Angolan and Congolese so-called refugees in Portland, Maine, of all places. And I was like, what in the world? You know, you don't think of that as a hotspot for refugee resettlement. But then again, you know, as I've started digging into this, and everyone knows about Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some of these places, but the more I've been digging into the refugee resettlement thing, you see Fargo, North Dakota, Boise, Idaho, now Portland, Maine, and Western Massachusetts is another place where that's been really targeted, and they all have one thing in common, and that's they're all overwhelmingly white and generally a bit less urban.
Fargo, North Dakota is a logical place for some of them equatorial third world country.
yeah, exactly.
Making things interesting, right?
Yeah, exactly. Get a little spice in there, a little diversity, and you know, that sort of thing. And it's bizarre. And you're thinking, okay, well, you know, as you said, it's not like there's some, you know, draw to it in terms of, oh, this is I have some climactic familiarity with this or something. You know, there's a, you know, Minnesota, you could see that as sort of an analog to Sweden or something, but it is definitely done intentionally, and it's definitely done with the aim to splinter social cohesion, but it also has an economic function too, which a lot of people neglect. And the major, you know, immigration in general, many people have commented on the fact that it's to drive down wages, and that's absolutely true. The other thing, though, is that typically the immigration waves are able to break the collective bargaining power of the immigrant group that comes before. And I talk about this in one of the pieces where, depending on what group and what area you're talking about, it's several successive waves of immigrants which arrive, and then they are able to sort of fracture the collective bargaining of the group that comes before. And what they've seem to have hit on now is that why bring in waves of different ethnic groups when you can bring in a whole smorgasbord, and then no one can talk to anyone, and there's no collective bargaining power whatsoever, and you can use pre-existing ethnic grievances to splinter these people so you keep your wages really low. And it also has that dual function of harming the indigenous whites that are there.
Yeah, this is like pluralism on steroids, I guess you could say. Diversity, again, it denies the community any cohesion, any sense of identity, and you can do this in the name. And often, this has been done domestically in the United States in the 20th century, when the ethnic neighborhoods in the, particularly the Catholic ones, were broken up in the name of integration. And this also, they flooded the northern factories, and this is the 1940s to into the 1960s. And this has also coincided with the interstate highway system being built by the government, of course, and also suburbia, which is built, it was a public-private partnership, really, with the FHA to create suburbia and the atomization that occurred from that. So there's a large-scale social engineering operation going on here. It comes in different waves, because I guess those in power, or the ruling elite have, you know, the agendas don't change, but there's different chapters that, you know, that play out here.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the other function is that the more violent the group is that is arriving, the more likely that's going to serve the function of kind of pushing people indoors and getting them to purchase things online and watch their Netflix and such. And then they're not as civically engaged, and you have kind of like a turtle effect, and all those things dovetail nicely with the sort of neoliberal agenda. So it really is a public-private partnership. And that's one thing I really wanted to hammer home with people, is that it's all well and good to understand what the government's doing, and it is doing, but people do not pay enough attention to the economic impetus to all this stuff. And the fact that it is very often corporations and banks driving it more than anyone, actually. And one of the major things that I hit on in this series is that in the one of these Refugee Resettlement Act sort of things, I forget the exact name of it, but in 1980, one was passed in the U.S., which is the one we're currently adhering to. And there's a small clause in there, which I did not know about until I turned this up in my research, that a state may opt out of it, which sounds great, except that clause then allows the government to designate a private charity or private charities to handle all of the refugee resettlement in that state, which thus removes the majority of the federal oversight. So ostensibly, you'd think that they'd have some because a ton of federal funding goes to these things, but they are independent organizations, and there's a whole lot more abuses and circumventing of refugee caps and all this other stuff that goes on. And now the major loophole they're exploiting is asylum. So you have a refugee cap of 30,000. I think next year it's going to be 15, but that doesn't mean anything when anyone can show up and claim asylum and then disappear into the internal part of the country. And so that's what they've been doing, is exploiting these asylum claims. And then in Maine's case, it's Catholic Charities is the sole refugee resettlement agency, and they basically paid for all the bus tickets for these hundreds of migrants who traveled at least 12,000 miles to get to their final destination. They paid for their bus tickets from San Antonio, Texas to Portland, Maine. I mean, that's just it. So this thing is totally inorganic and it's totally artificial. And anyone who says, oh, it's inevitable, there's just these talking points, because that does not happen as a natural process. It just simply does not.
You don't naturally migrate from the west coast of Africa to Minnesota?
I wouldn't, wouldn't be my first thought, And,
like a trade winds or something, right?
Right, exactly. And what sparked my – so this kind of came across my radar, and then someone had written I'm trying to remember what he used as an alias, but someone had posted something to Medium about this situation in Portland in particular. And I read through it, and I'm like, wow, this is really interesting. So I started just digging into it, and I uncovered a bunch of stuff about some of the smaller towns. And basically – we like to joke a lot about the fact that there's a lot of people in the kind of dissident right who have weaponized autism. And I tell people, I've weaponized OCD. So I basically become interested in something and I can't let it go. I'm like a dog with a bone. So I'm like, all right, well, who's responsible for this? And how does this work together? And so I've just kept – originally I was just going to do a handful of pieces. Now, as you mentioned, I'm up to 10. I have four others written. I try to release them every couple of days, so I'm holding off on those. And there's at least two or three more I have yet to write to try and capture everything that I know in all of its dimensions. And what I'm hoping is that people can read this. And this, like I said, this was just kind of it pinged on my radar and I started pursuing it. I could have picked anywhere, as I mentioned, Fargo or Minneapolis or Boise or anywhere. And I'm hoping that people look at what's going on and they follow kind of the pattern that I'm laying out. And even if it's not the exact same principal actors, it is going to be the same archetype. So you have the major refugee resettlement agencies, which have kind of a degree of autonomy from the U.S., and then ones that are private, and then they can have subcontractors and all these other things. And then people can look into wherever they are and say, all right, here is kind of who has a vested interest in this, who's sponsoring it, who's allowing this to happen. And hopefully we can create a pretty in-depth map of where things are coming from and going, and then kind of chart out the whole network. And I think that would be very useful. And I'm hoping this can be a template for people.
Yeah. I'm getting into the weeds, and this is very important because there is agency here. There are organizations made up of individuals who've decided to do this, and the political process, the foundations, the banking system, the corporations have set up, a system where people are rewarded and paid to do this, not to mention it fulfills a sort of ideological or moral pretension that these people may have, particularly something like Catholic Charities. Catholic Charities itself is an interesting case because it's been criticized for decades by traditional right-wing Orthodox Catholics as being liberal outfit, more or less being a welfare agency. It kind of lost its soul in the 1960s. And it started out, you have the efforts in in the turn late 19th century. This is Archbishop John Hughes in New York helping a lot of the Irish out to kind of become Americans, sort of to come to the mainstream of American life. And he emphasized the importance of of living a moral, upright life and turning away from sin at the same time becoming a good citizen because you're doing that. He recognized that there were behavioral problems among the immigrant population. It wasn't the sort of the 1960s welfare mentality where you know, any attempt to impose accountability upon the recipient of charity was blaming the victim. Well, that became sort of an ideological view in the 1960s with the development of welfare rights, and that was weaponized too. The welfare system was weaponized to also break up these neighborhoods and promote criminal behavior. That was exposed in the 1970s in the congressional hearings about the funding of certain criminal gangs like the Blackstone Rangers in Chicago to break up an ethnic Polish neighborhood, I believe. And they were getting like close to $1 million a year from the Office of Economic Opportunity that was then run by Sergeant Shriver. So that's a case study right there. A lot of these uplift programs can be weaponized, and they often are. Since the 60s, Catholic Charities have become sort of just a welfare agency, and from what I understand, just sort of a liberal activist. But you mentioned 1980, that law where, you know, more or less the immigration and some of the programs designed to facilitate people immigrating to the country was farmed out to private organizations. So I guess this helped the growth of what we call now NGOs. And this has created a situation where there's little or no accountability, but it's just through the NGOs. It's almost the same way that an outfit like Z or Triple Canopy, or what's the other one? Privatized military security forces. You know, how they can do a lot of the work now with very little, military contractors like in Iraq or something. At the same time, a foreign policy is being carried out in the Middle East or North Africa that's destabilizing these countries and creating the refugee crisis, and therefore creating a pretext for claims of asylum, which are probably never really vetted or really investigating. A lot of them, these people just seeking, quote, a better life, which isn't really asylum. But when you have a country that's torn apart, with strife and civil war, they can make all types of claims. And then, because it's assumed that it's the burden of European or American countries to take in refugees. I don't know where that's written in any constitution or not. You get in this article about how something like Catholic Charities is a recipient of government largesse and also a lot of charity funding, how these charities sort of, they launder money, they recycle money, go back and forth to promote a certain policy. Oddly enough, Catholic Charities is a big beneficiary of Jewish charity.
Why is that? Without getting into too much of maybe the Converso crypto stuff from Vatican II and all that, but as far as from a social engineering perspective, it gives them that plausible deniability. So what you have is a situation where, and the Jewish lobby has proven, and Jewish ethnic interests, they've proven very good at doing this kind of stuff, where they're able to kind of get in there and infiltrate the organization in one way or another. So the Catholic Charities, at least in the situation that I've been looking at in Maine, and to a lesser, not to a lesser degree, but a situation I know a little less about, but I've uncovered some details, would be in Boston. The information that I've uncovered as far as Boston, because it's not like the primary focus of my research, but is that they've been basically sending money up to the Jewish Federation in Portland, and then the Catholic Charities as well, and they kind of work in conjunction. So these major refugee resettlement organizations, one of them's Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, but there's eight other ones that are nominally Christian, I believe, and they don't want to have a visibly disproportionate influence so much, so they use these sort of things as a battering ram, and then they'll enter into conjunction, as a partnership for social justice and these kinds of things. And they also have a lot of corporate partnerships, and the particular influence there is obviously also heavily Jewish. So they're able to use the kind of private sector money, and they're creating a lot of kind of shell philanthropic organizations that they're able to donate to, which then can donate to Catholic Charities or kind of do their own, quote, advocacy. And there's all these little loopholes and a lot of moving money around and that kind of thing. So sometimes I've even encountered one organization will donate I don't know, let's say $50,000 to this other organization, which also donated money to that same organization. So they basically just exchanged money, and they basically just try to keep it moving as much as possible. So it's really hard to pin it down. And you have to do, I mean, the amount of research I've had to do for this series alone is ridiculous. I mean, hours upon hours upon hours, just trying to chase down these little minutia. And I think, though, that's why it's so effective, is because it's a ton of smoke and mirrors. And so then people can't just say, there's a heavy Jewish influence, for example. So, Catholic Charities is terrible, and the things that they're doing are terrible, but they're kind of, it's kind of like when people talk about globalism, they talk about the Clintons. It's a symptom more than anything else, and they're kind of really more of a front.
Yeah, there's interesting. There's a book that I recommend by E. Michael Jones called John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution, a case study in Philadelphia in the 1960s, how integration was used to break up the Irish and Italian neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And they attempted the Polish ones too. So the Polish were more resilient, from what I understand. But basically, it was using sort of integration as a way to break up the ethnic neighborhood and the ethnic Catholic neighborhoods. These had very significant political implications, these neighborhoods, or they had power because of their ethnic identity and their cohesiveness and their concentration. One thing was they were holding back, some of the liberal agenda in the 1960s. One thing was the government support for birth control. And so this one district in Philadelphia was Most Blessed Sacrament Parish was targeted for integration, sort of gerrymandered, flooded with migrants, I think, largely from Georgia in the 50s and 60s. And as a result, by the 1970s, that neighborhood had been broken up and the Catholic power had been broken because most of the Catholics had migrated, white flight into the suburbs where they were still Catholic, but they lost their identity because now they were sort of atomized. They were deracinated into the greater, whiter population, white population of suburbia. And from the standpoint of the Catholic Church in the Archdiocese in Philadelphia, it didn't matter because they're still a member of the Archdiocese, still due paying members. But once you break the demographics change and the physical locale changes, you lose your Catholic identity, and then you can be deracinated and be subject to all the psychological warfare that, that modern America has to offer with entertainment and these things. But it's interesting, it's something that integration, which was sort of assumed to be the morally upright position since the 1960s, or just a priori, the morally superior position, so you couldn't really oppose it. The Catholic hierarchy didn't understand this, or at least many of them were involved in it. But there's a Catholic Interracial Council that supported it. The Quakers are behind us. This is very similar to Catholic Charities. The Quakers were a big force supporting integration. But the main, the pretext or the excuse was integration. But it didn't integrate because people just left. The neighbors just, population displacement. They were replaced. It was ethnic warfare because the people just left. That was the excuse. But the effect was both political and cultural, and you simply couldn't have had the cultural revolution, the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s with demographics of the 1940s or 50s. So, and what's interesting is that study, also in his book, The Slaughter of Cities, he marks out a long, thought out, vicious psychological warfare operation to bring about this very result that we see today. And this was done domestically. And what I see in your articles is now it's being applied internationally, where whereas the conquered, impoverished South was used to break up the ethnic neighborhoods in the North, now you have the impoverished, war-stricken Third World or economically depressed, Latin America and these things. Now the oligarchs now recognize they have more or less a surplus slave population they can use. They can move them around the world and to weaken any opposition they have to their hegemony or their agenda, which is lower wages, a slave wage class. Would you agree that's a fair characterization of what's going on?
Oh yeah, definitely. And you see it's most prominent in Western countries, but it's not exclusive to Western countries. I've talked to a few nationalists from other countries, from South America to even Southeast Asia, and they're using the same group. They're predominantly, these days, it's predominantly mestizos in the Western Hemisphere, but also a huge amount of Sub-Saharan Africans, especially. They have a bumper crop, I guess you could say, of them because of all the subsidization that goes into the, quote, foreign aid, which mm-hmm. is, we're talking trillions of dollars at this point. And it will have, I think, quintupled by the end of the century from 1990 or 1980. So we're talking about just gigantic increase, and they're being sent to places like Indonesia even to undercut cohesion and wages and all this other stuff. So we're seeing this applied across the world. And the point that I make to people is, you know, you might think maybe it's a white issue or whatever. And I mean, obviously people should be concerned first and foremost with their own group, but the whole end game of globalism is one gigantic sort of cafe con leche society, which is a giant slave class or serf class to this little bit at the top, and everywhere will be sort of vaguely the same.
Yeah, this is global homo, as they say.
It is, basically, yeah. And that is the end game. That is what they're looking to do, and they find different groups that can create wedges, and you know, they can exploit, as I mentioned, ethnic grievances or historical grievances, like in Europe. The majority of the so-called refugees that are arriving in Europe are not small persecuted minorities from the Middle East. It's not, I mean, yeah, they take some Christians and some of these other small religious sects, but it's mostly Muslims. And then they sort of stoke historical resentment and get them radicalized and go in attacking the indigenous European population. And then those people, their offspring generally, if they're not kind of going the route of becoming radical jihadists, which, to be fair, most don't, but their use is that use for terrorism is to indeed to terrorize and cow people. They only need a few to do that. The rest are just good little consumers.
Yeah, that, set up, or a lumpen proletariat who sit around and make life miserable for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So they're finding different groups to do all these things, but that is it is the end goal for everywhere. That this is what they want to do. And so it's not a surprise that you start seeing a very strongly nationalist axis forming in opposition to globalism. And that axis, you see Syria, Iran, Russia, even to some degree China, actually, with their, at least regarding the Han interests, in opposition to. And the thing is, the Chinese are an interesting case because they're perfectly willing to work with the globalists to pursue their own agenda, and they are an expansionary empire, actually. But some of the other countries, they're just deeply concerned with preserving their own culture and heritage, and that's why you see these axes forming, where you have basically globalism and nationalism about to come to blows. And as far as what shape that's ultimately going to take, we're not sure. But I mean, Eastern Europe versus Western Europe, for example, is another fault line that mm-hmm. we're seeing. And Western Europe saying, look, we're going to impose sanctions on you, we're going to do all this stuff, you have to accept quotas. And they're saying, well, no, we have national sovereignty and we're not going to do it. And there's all these little loopholes and extra governmental things that they're trying there, just like as we can see in the United States. I mean, the Civil War was the triumph of federalism, and we see now that they're trying to do that. And, you know, Tennessee, to their credit, has sued the federal government on 10th Amendment grounds. But like I said, if it's privatized, it doesn't matter, because they're able to do things in a way that's generally removed from what the government is saying. I mean, if it happens to align with government policy, that's great. But the thing is, government policy is a reflection of the people that are behind the government, not the actual politicians. So it is, again, these corporations and multinationals and banks and stuff. They run the country like a corporation insofar as it will be useful, and then they'll dissolve it in the sort of larger globalist picture. Mm-hmm. And that's really the thing. So the people that are concerned about the government, they're right, but that's kind of how I moved from being a libertarian to more of a third positionist, because I was like, well, the only thing that can really produce a commensurate force to counteract this is a strong state that's willing to protect its own people, because otherwise there's nothing else that can do that. So the only answer, to my mind, to this kind of corporate tyranny is you have to take control of the state and use its machinery to drive these people out and to put them back in the kind of box that they need to be in, which is it's not dictating policy for the countries, because it's not that it's not conducive to freedom or happy lives or anything for most people. It's just a profit motive.
In your latest piece, the 10th edition or episode in this series, you write about some of the rural America and how some of the meatpacking plants is a good illustration of how this has played out, and the decline in wages, how in 1980 you could earn a livable wage working one of these plants, and then they flooded this area with labor from Latin America to drive down wages to maximize, you know, profits for an international corporation that has no loyalty to a particular area nor country. But at the same time, this has had a grievous effect on the locality, the area, the quality of life. And so they've more or less externalized the cost. At the same time, oddly enough, they're using taxpayer dollars to subsidize this stuff, because a lot of these people who come to work in these plants end up on public relief, welfare. At the same time, they're being subsidized by tax-free foundations to move these people around like so many pawns in a game.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just the ultimate scam, because most of them don't pay any corporate tax or very little. And then again, their profit is underwritten by the fact that the people are not earning a livable wage, and so they go on welfare. And you have a situation where you have people basically subsidizing their own replacement. I mean, it's really extremely insidious when you look at how they're doing it. But the thing is, of course, you know, it's kind of a basic talking point, but it doesn't make it any less true that, of course, the politicians are bought and sold. So they're going to do what the corporate and financial interests tell them to do. And that was one of the things, I haven't touched on it too much yet in the pieces I've published, a bit in, I think, maybe volume 5, but it is coming, where I'm looking at that and saying, look, here are these sort of organizations that, you know, your Council of Foreign Relations and those types of things that these people belong to, and they rub elbows with the big multinational interests. And then here's how the campaign donations come into play and all of that stuff. And it is a genuine serious issue. But strangely, this used to be something the left wing used to talk a lot about globalization and money and politics and stuff. And they're just silent about it now, just like the anti-war thing. There's just almost nothing coming from that side. It's pretty much just people on the dissident right now that are going, whoa, wait a second, workers' rights, all this stuff that the left used to claim province over is just gone. There's just hard. I mean, there are a few that express, you know, that are objecting to this kind of stuff, but it's coming pretty much from us for the most part. I mean, there's really not much else out there that's objecting to this. And I think most people implicitly agree with us. I truly don't think there's anything all that, quote, radical about what we believe. I think it's generally pretty normal and reasonable. And the real radical and extreme rhetoric is from the people that are pushing all this just crazy nonsense, the social reengineering and all these things that are totally unnatural and can only be kept together through a giant apparatus, which is able to kind of move this money around and people around. But the problem for them is that it's a house of cards and it's largely a Ponzi scheme. And eventually the bill is going to come due and they will not be able to pay it. And unfortunately, the fallout is going to be catastrophic in a lot of ways. However, it also means we're going to have a chance to reshape things back in line with how they should be.
Yeah. You mentioned the sort of the abandonment of the left, of workers' rights, the traditional concerns of the left. Now, this was, I think, illustrated in 1975 with Michel Foucault. It's sort of they call it the Death Valley Agreement, where apparently a deal was struck that the oligarchs would make him sort of the celebrity academician, sort of the voice of the left out there at Berkeley, I think. And in return, he would promote sexual liberation and sort of abandon the traditional issues that you were alluding to. And since the 1970s, what has sort of, I think, typified or really characterize leftist things is the identity of identity politics based on one form of sexual degeneration or something, sort of sexual perversion, gay rights and these things, transgenderism, as we've seen now in the past 10 years. It's gotten more and more absurd, and that's how these things go, that they sort of the reduction ad absurdum of sort of liberalism itself, ultimate consumerism. I can decide what sex I am, even change from day to day. But this was promoted by Michel Foucault in the 70s and 80s. And this is an idea that you promote sexual liberation as a form of psychological warfare to enslave people, because you make them enslaved to their passions. And as a man has many masters as he has passions or vices, as St. Augustine said. And this is what's happened here, where people can now indulge whatever sexual perversion or fantasy that they've been trained to have by the media. And this is being also being promoted in the media, the cultural war and these things, and in the schools and media. I mean, Hollywood itself is just one big promotion of sexual liberation or sexual perversion or sexual degeneracy. And this also is largely a function, or at least a allowed by the change in demographics, was another consequence of the destruction of the Catholic urban neighborhoods, was the decline of the production code and also the Legions of Decency, which is a Catholic organization that enforced it. Because prior to that, Catholic Church could marshal a boycott. And after the Catholics went into suburbia, they simply didn't have the organization wherewithal, the consciousness to threaten boycotts anymore. And interesting enough, the production code collapsed in the mid-60s as a result of, largely a result of one film called The Pawnbroker. And it was a movie about a Holocaust survivor. And in the movie, they show bare breasts. But you couldn't criticize that movie without being anti-Semitic. So here's the trick. So they demoralize you with this stuff. And this might get into some other things you talk about, is that we are unable to identify the agency and the organizations that are doing this, because the very organizations and agencies that are doing this are a member of a protected group. And if you mention their names, you'll get pulled from YouTube. You'll be named anything. If you're influential enough or well-known enough, the ADL will put you on their hit list. And that's an important factor in this, because you mentioned weaponized migration and the NGOs that are doing this, and there's and we kind of referred to it, but Jewish organizations play a very important role in this. And in your piece, you say that there was a time when people rightly identified Bolshevism with Jews, in the same way today neoliberalism can be identified with Jewish agency or Jewish issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And they definitely have strongly tethered a lot of these things together. And, you do see the heavily Jewish presence in all these things. And it includes, for example, the media ownership in the state of Maine. So the guy who owns 6 of the 7 largest newspapers in Maine and prints the 7th is a Jewish guy who has an admitted ethnic grudge, well, ethno-religious, I guess you'd say, grudge against white Christians, because apparently someone called him a name once. And he's carrying that out, and he refuses to publish anything that contradicts the narrative of, migration good. And so you have all the papers of note. It's a private monopoly in the state of Maine. And it's not just the 7 that he's, again, effectively controls all 7, including the printing of one, but there's a number of weeklies and specialty publications. I mean, he pretty much controls all of the local media. There's hardly any dissenting voices out there. So you have the situation, and the guy who owned the majority of the major papers before him was another Jew, Donald Sussman, who is a very shady character and was married to one of the representatives from the state of Maine, and let her use his private jet, donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to her campaign through his law firm. He has a bunch of shell corporations and tax haven loophole stuff. He operates out of the Virgin Islands, and it's very shady. And it's not a place that you associate with having corrupt politics. You think of Tammany Hall or something, but it's, when you start digging into the intersection of the political and the private spheres in Maine, it's very sordid. And the Jewish influence is even more exaggerated because I don't even know if they're 1% of the population, but they're just as outsized, if not more so, in the goings on in the state. It's, you know, again, they're not exclusive actors. Of course, there's plenty of Shabbos Goyim who are happy to help and make money off the whole thing. But it's very sordid and it is deeply tied to all these things. And so the Jewish organizations that are there, the Jewish Federation and some of the private charities, they've also become very entrenched through funding in the college system. And that includes both public and private. The University of Maine Law School and all of these things, they're all working in tandem with each other. And if you look at, you throw a dart, pick an organization and look at who are the partner organizations, who donates to them, et cetera, you'll start seeing the same names recur again and again and again. You'll see the Maine Holocaust and Human Rights Center, and they have their propaganda that they put out, and they sponsor the Maine Jewish Film Festival, which does this certain thing. And then, you know, an affiliate of theirs writes something for HuffPost, and then they have other stuff syndicated. It's all the thing is, it is all interconnected. It's not necessarily all working in conjunction at the exact same time, but there's enough overlap, commonality, and common interest that they essentially get their way, and they're able to exert their outsized influence either through the private charity aspect or through ownership of private companies. And another thing too that I've found is that a lot of outside organizations will purchase companies in Maine and sort of use the pretext of it being a local company to advance their agenda and hike up their profits, such as Poland Spring Water is owned by Nestle. And Nestle has a track record for very underhanded practices to highlight or to add to the bottom line and to add more profit. And we have, if anyone wants to look into the situation in Flint, Michigan, Nestle is very much involved in that, and their profits are tied to the fact, beyond the demographics of Flint that have allowed it to disintegrate. That's also by design.
Actually. Are you, were they behind the spoilization of the public water system to boost sales of bottled water?
Well, basically what happened is the public utilities were privatized in Flint, and they were basically allowed to disintegrate. And there was a tax break given to Nestle to have a giant bottling station pretty much right next door. And I need to do some more research in it. But then they've been making a killing. I think
you don't have to be an MBA to figure out what.
Yeah, then you can see what happens, and yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you don't want to call it a conspiracy. Call it a business model,
right? And it is. It is, and that's what's happened all throughout. It's a model that they first really started perfecting in Africa after colonization, and what they would do is they would have the government privatize businesses that belong to people that or industries that belong to people that were out of the globalist network. They pretty much hung a lot of the ex-colonists out to dry, and it would fail, and they would bring in a private organization to take control of it, and or there would be some private company that would have to step in and provide services. So the Flint model was perfected in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's ongoing today, as we can see. And
yeah, I mean, you can set up local satraps or corrupt officials that are much more easily to deal with or manage than, say, hardworking colonials who, you know, like in South Africa or something, right?
You know, right. Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. There's someone I don't go off, but like there's a Jewish hand behind some of the farm seizures in South Africa now.
The primary financier of the economic freedom fighters is a Jew from, I think, Namibia, named Nathan Kirsch. And yeah, and he's behind, it's like every, you know, they have that meme every single time, but like is every single time.
Jeez, is really something, because it's sort of this neoliberal model where there's no ethics or morality. It's all, you know, profit and really it's not even that, because what they do is there's ways that you can hide coercion, right? You can stoke, create a civil war and force people off their land, have proxies do this for you. And all of a sudden you have a surplus, you know, urban population that can now man a factory. And then all of a sudden Nike comes in and goes, look at all this cheap labor. We can move it from America, you know, to Latin America or a South Asia somewhere. And you know, they've been doing this ever since the days of the British East India Company. You know, it's a 500-year model.
They're perfecting it, and they have – the reason it's accelerating is because, you know, now you have cheap airfare and the ability to move populations much more easily, large numbers of people. And they recognize that, yeah, this is a great model for profit. And there have been a number of studies that have in the United States that have found that immigrant populations purchase more bottled water than others. And whether that I haven't dug enough into it to say whether that's because the local infrastructure is generally worse in the places that they live or whether or not that's just a natural compulsion, I don't know. But what happens is basically then the bottled water companies such as Poland Spring and Maine, they get the exclusive rights to use these springs and other areas, aquifers and things to bottle the water. But then the locals don't have it. And, you know, you have a situation then where if the local infrastructure goes to hell due to mismanagement or it's privatized and the company there cuts corners, whatever the case may be, I mean, you have to have water. So it creates a demand for obviously the bottled water.
Wasn't Maurice Strong behind some plan like this in Canada, in the Midwest? There's a huge aquifer. He was, you know, Rockefeller guy, but there's a huge aquifer there that they tried to privatize.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Huh. It was a similar scheme.
I want to say Nestle even has gotten caught out just using tap water. Which is even more preposterous. It's like, so just reselling you the same shitty water you're trying not to drink.
Mm-hmm. It's, but it is, you have a situation, where, again, you have, these agencies or groups that are beyond criticism or scrutiny, because if you do criticize them, identify them as, you know, who they are and who they represent, you're immediately, you know, called, you know, names and
you know, it's right. Yeah. And you'll say, oh, well, it's, you know, this kind of globalist mindset. And they'll say, whoa, that's a dog whistle for anti-Semitism.
Cosmopolitan. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Cosmopolitan and all these other things. The most recent one I saw and I couldn't stop laughing was they were insisting that referring to tentacles is anti-Semitic.
Like, Leviathan. I mean, well, David Icke was accused because of his lizard theory or something.
Oh yeah, and it's like methinks the lady does protest too much. You know, it's like
you're talking about us.
Yeah, lizards. What do you say about the Jews? No, I didn't. And three quarters of the time, you're not even necessarily talking about them. They're saying, oh well, globalism this and that, and it's like, well, that is in fact what they're doing. And you know, communism was the first vehicle to try to take advantage of that idea of internationalism and all that other stuff. But they found that it didn't work well enough for their purposes because, again, we're talking about statism and the power becomes too explicitly concentrated in the hands of the state. And you can see disproportionate Jewish influence, particularly like if you're talking about the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And so you switch vehicles and you go, okay, well, neoliberalism actually is a much more effective one because you're still talking about internationalism and globalism, but you can obscure things much more easily. And it's much easier to not have accountability to people. So people can engage in large scale protests against a repressive government. Yeah. I suppose you could engage in boycotts, which is great. And it's really effective. But like you said, now that you've undermined that, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to push back against that? Especially when now the laws are such that it really has turned into an oligarchy. So you say, well, I don't want to, you know, support these companies. So I'm going to go from, you know, I don't want to support Nestle. And of course they don't advertise who they own, the different brands. So you could say, well, you know, Nestle, they use bottled water. I'm going to go buy some, you know, Poland Spring or something. And it's all going to the same place. I mean, but they're not making it explicit that they own the company, obviously. So you get the illusion of choice when really you trace it back to just a couple of multinationals that have a hand in everything. And another thing that I've noticed, this is, I'm still doing some research on this. So as I was saying, there's still a few more pieces I have yet to write. It's this nexus of what they call, I saw one of the CEOs refer to it as philanthropic capitalism. Some people call that the whole woke capital or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not, it goes beyond just branding social activism. To there are things like donor advised funds, which are masquerading as private charities, but they have much less accountability and oversight because they're quote charities, and they're purchasing stocks, and they're basically becoming another market unto themselves, and they can engage in much more explicit social engineering because it's so-called charity. And again, it's not just like it's Catholic charities, it's a ton of these things, and they're worth billions if you add it all together. And so they're basically trying to create this whole new model, which is even more powerful than what we've seen so far and will continue to be.
In the 1960s, the Ford and Rockefeller foundations were the engines for social change. And what they would do is they would fund a research, and so the research would come across as sort of scientific, and then the press would promote it, and then the government would implement it in policy. And it seemed very diverse, and it seemed like you know the best minds coming together and devising a policy when it was all centrally controlled, through very few people in these foundations who are usually connected back to the Council on Foreign Relations or something like that. The same thing later in the 70s with the Trilateral Commission. The now what you have here is with woke, so-called woke capital, is you can carry out social engineering, social alchemy through such things as not just the kind of ads you run and the causes you support, but also through your so-called human resources department, because you can promote, you can without any laws being passed, you can suppress free speech, terms and conditions, like with YouTube and these things. And you can, through human resources, you can hire certain people who are very comfortable being in those positions, women and homosexuals often. They'll impose the regulations and compliance without any laws being passed. So pretty soon you're forced to celebrate gay pride in the month of June because your company wants you to. And you can't go to another company that isn't celebrating gay pride. I was listening to a guy talk today in an interview. He said he's in Canada, and he was taking a trip up to go see the southern part of the Arctic Ocean. And there's a small town just south of that in Canada. And he goes into there, and everywhere there's gay pride flags. this isn't, his point is this isn't organic, it's just top down. It's being implemented. And this one thing is you can do this through the corporations, world capital. You can bring about social change just through that. And it's all very centrally controlled because these corporations are controlled by a few thousand people who have this neoliberal agenda who want to carry out global homo. And it's creating not just, global homo, we're talking about homosexuality and sexual degeneracy, because through that you create the atomized society, you break up, you destroy ethnic identity and family and community through that. And that's, very effective in doing, and they've done that. But also you can create a sort of a global homogenized society. And so that you knock down barriers to markets. So it's these two things are connected, really. But the whole point is again, no laws are being explicitly passed, right? There's no explicit laws, but nevertheless, the boot's coming down on us anyway through terms and conditions and human resource departments.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the big part of this is also the concentration of the economy, because small mid-sized companies aren't in on it. But this is where the money power comes into play. And I think you've talked about this, is through the concentration of capital, manipulation of capital and control of the money supply, who controls the banks, they can progressively concentrate and corporatize the entire economy, which is why when you go into any town now, you see the same stores anywhere, right? It's all Starbucks, and it's all chain restaurants. Nothing's owned individually anymore.
Yeah, exactly. They run the little guy out. They can just spend him into the ground. And, through compound interest and stuff, they're able to basically just continue to have the money replicating itself. And lo and behold, they're the ones who control it. They're the ones who set up the system. So the idea that you're going to kind of that you're going to be able to combat this in any meaningful way, because the system is just it's a runaway train at this point. The only way you're going to do that is if you have a government that says, guess what, we're going to go to an alternate form of currency, or we're going to fully nationalize the banks and focus the money supply within our own country. Or maybe you set up a sort of somewhat of an alternative type economy like the NSDAP tried to do in Germany, those types of things. And that is, to my mind, that's the only way you're going to be able to stop this. And the reason I think they're really heavily going after some of these Muslim countries beyond their proximity to Israel is the fact that they still generally have much more strict religious commitments, particularly in terms of things like interest, where just like Christians, you're not supposed to engage in usury. Mm-hmm. But they've mostly corrupted at least Western Christians. I think in Eastern Europe, and even in some Southern European countries, they're running into much more pronounced opposition. But the Muslims will move to the West, and they'll give each other interest-free loans. They'll try to circumvent the banking system so that they don't have to sacrifice that aspect of their, of their religion and the things that they believe. So I think the other thing too is they want to get a hold of these guys and break that as a major weapon with which to resist globalism. I mean, if you look at the Iranian Revolution, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, that was a consequence of U.S. foreign policy and stuff. It's like, yes, actually, yes, it was. But it was an organic counterreaction to so-called westernization. And they wanted to preserve their culture, so they did it in this way. And do we agree with everything in it? No. But it's also a different culture, and it's not really on us to dictate what their standards should be when they are not us. And then that's why I call myself a self-determinationist, because I think every group should be allowed to determine their own trajectory without being molested, manipulated, attacked, and so on. And what's best for Iran is not necessarily what's going to be best for Norway, which is not what's necessarily going to be best for America.
Yeah, it depends on the culture. And Iran, you have the Council of, I guess, Elders, I think, which is sort of a Platonic vision. But in the West, you know, we think of ourselves as individuals, individually free, and so we don't have, I think, the intellectual or consciousness to protect ourselves from these things. The West is very vulnerable to a group, to a cohesive, you know, minority group that acts in its own interest. Whereas they, you know, if you preach atomization and individualism, and you have one group that preaches that but acts collectively and acts in its own interest, you're going to have a political and economic problem. There was a time there was some recognition of this, but that there was a time when Western societies were more, they were more cohesive and. They identified as particularly Christian, maybe even Catholic societies. And so when you had an alien group, say like the Jews, like in France, you could articulate the argument and say, you have a group which is alien to the prevailing values of our society. And therefore, if they behave contrary to our values, we're going to have special rules for this group. That was sort of the rule before Napoleon, the Napoleonic era, when Jewish emancipation reigned. And I think it was in 1891, the Catholic Church published in their magazine, Civiltà Cattolica, called The Jewish Question. And this was more or less a reflection on 100 years since the French Revolution. Basically, they came to the conclusion that since the French Revolution and the murder of the king and the destruction of the theocratic basis of that society, France was delivered on to be dominated by Jews. And as you read this 1891 article, it's like a dissident right wing about the concentration of Jews in banks and these things, the corruption of society and these things. And it called for certain, policies or ways to deal with this. But you need a sort of an integralism to society that the West doesn't have, because we live in an atomized liberal society where we're pluralistic, where there isn't, you know, in the United States, we don't have that idea, of a common religion, common ethic and faith. And so if you live in an atomized individualistic society, very vulnerable to a corruption from an organized group, which apparently has occurred in the West.
Yeah, and I think especially I was listening to something maybe last week, but it was Occidental Quarterly. They do sort of like a live stream, and they had Professor Fraser Andrew Fraser from Australia. Well, I don't know if he's Australian, but anyway, he lives there. And basically he and Dr. McDonald had mentioned something to the effect of it seems like the Anglo-Saxons in particular are uniquely vulnerable to this. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a genetic thing, because it's certainly, if you've got everywhere from New Zealand to Canada to, you know, even pretty much the Anglo influence in South Africa is gone. But, you know, all these far afield territories all basically suffering from the same malady almost simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, some of it's a function of globalism, but the way in which it's manifested itself in each one of these societies has been almost identical. There's just something in the way the Anglo-Saxon is, just the genetic makeup of the Anglo-Saxon to be more contractual and more focused on these ideas of a contractual bond as opposed to a blood tie. I mean, it does allow to create these very complex societies to a degree, but it also really, relative to other Indo-European peoples, makes a very weak bond, which is very easy to exploit. And it's no surprise why England was ground zero for neoliberalism in Europe and to spread this all around.
And this coincided with sort of the consanguinity of the Jewish people with their British aristocracy, correct? In the 19th century?
Yeah, I read, I think it's Andrew Joyce wrote an awesome article about that. They basically tether their interests together, which they've done the same thing in the United States. And that's how you're able to rope non-Jewish interests into that, and so that way their interests basically become so intertwined there's no daylight between the two. And you know, that's terrible in the current era we're living in, because the elites, even Jewish or not, is still a reflection, as I mentioned, like with neoliberalism, that system is a reflection on those people, and it benefits those people, Jew, of course, but also the kind of philo-Semites that they're intermarried with, or that they're controlling, or whatnot.
Well, yeah, the society becomes Judaized, and they themselves internalize the Talmudic principles, and then you can see that in our banking system. You see that, you know, I'm not absolving the general public of responsibility. People have a responsibility to make the right decisions, but it helps if you have the grammar and the information. Because much of the psychological warfare is blunted or neutralized if you're aware of it, and this is what we're trying to do here. Hilaire Belloc, who was a great Catholic writer in the early 20th century, now is considered anti-Semite because he wrote a book called The Jews. And he talked about this problem. Here's the problem is you have a group, the liberal presumption or idea is that everyone is an equal citizen in the liberal order. And we're all equal. But at the same time, Jews, just on the basis of the Zionist claims a special relationship. And so they have a dual loyalty, or at least a competing loyalty, or I think dual loyalty might be an improvement. But I mean, the point is that if they acknowledge that they are different and special, then at the same time that would justify special laws to deal with this special relationship. One would be is maybe increased scrutiny or suspicion about Jews in high office in any government because of their loyalty to a foreign government or to an international group. And this is, you know, the Zionist state, it was incarnated in Israel, but it existed prior to that, because you simply wouldn't have had the formation of Israel without organization. You know, when people accuse me of talking too much about Jewish influence or power, they say, well, explain to me the creation of Israel then. It wasn't an act of God. It wasn't nature. It took agency, yeah. Right? And I can name the agencies, by the way. I can name the people if you want to know. But the point being is that in the past, there was some recognition of this, meaning that special laws and restrictions were applied, or just a general consciousness or suspicion. But since the Second World War and the Holocaust narrative, that suspicion now is considered anti-Semitic. You're a Nazi. This brought about the Holocaust. What are you going to do? What do you want to put, you know, arm patches on them and these things? But if you look at the history, though, if you look at all these influential figures, like the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis, where it turns out he was a member of a Jewish secret society that worked against the interest of the United States for the interest of Israel. And same with his protege, Felix Frankfurter. And many of these Jewish editors and gangsters are all working, you know, for the Jewish formation of the Jewish state. So increased scrutiny, if you look at the history, seems to be justified. Even today, we have, you know, where you have people in Congress working for the presidential administrations. Every time we have a delegate or representative to the Middle East, he's Jewish. As if he's he's objective or something. And then the open talk about special relationship of Israel. You have the Greater Israel Organizations, Big Israel, as it's called, where, you know, aid bills are just passed automatically through Congress. Now, I think a lot of this is just people's, understanding of things. They're told they have to believe this because if they don't, they lose their congressional seat. Blackmail and bribery play a big part of this. And this, what we saw a lot of that with the Epstein, you know, could sort of get exposed with the Epstein case, the Epstein network. But there used to be a recognition of this, and now there isn't, and now they have free run. You know, it's coming back now because the guy PewDiePie withdrew his $50,000 donation because of the reactions.
I saw that. It was awesome.
So, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think if nothing else, the one upshot to having people like Ilhan Omar is that you can see that people are given carte blanche to attack her simply because she transgressed and criticized AIPAC and Israel.
Yeah, there was, and of course, Mike Enoch. He said it's the only time Republicans have balls to attack a black woman.
And I mean, it's so true. It's so true. And it's highly ironic that she's, of all people, is criticizing people for dual loyalty. Uh-huh. But there you have it. And I think that I would hope anyway, that opened a lot of people's eyes to all of a sudden there was universal condemnation from left and right of Ilhan Omar. And the only other time you ever see that is if someone expresses their white identity or even like Steve King says something like, well, what's wrong with Western values? Not Judeo-Christian, which is a joke, but what about What did he say? You can't rebuild your civilization with someone else's babies. And that's obviously true. That's axiomatic. But that's because he's white. That's, oh my God. You know, oh God, he can't say that. And, you know, those are really the only two instances. And I try to be as positive as possible. And I'm hoping that enough people are seeing this, you know, and it's activating something inside of them and go, wait a second. I think the race thing, I don't know to what degree about the Jewish thing, but it may not matter long term if the end result is the same. So, for example, I had a conversation with someone who was very outspoken. I can't reveal this. I promised I wouldn't. I kept the conversation off the record, but it's been a very outspoken critic of a heavily Jewish dominated industry. Never mentions them, but goes right at it and uses a variety of different arguments against this industry. And I think that if we're not able to make people explicitly aware of what they're doing, at the very least, if you can make people aware of aspects of it that they disproportionately benefit, it doesn't have to necessarily even name them, but we can harm that, you know, harm them there and kind of reconquer those areas which are rightfully ours, i.e. like national sovereignty. So the immigration debate, you know, that the immigration lobby and breaking open the border is obviously heavily Jewish influenced. I mean, everyone talks about Ted Kennedy, but the guy's a scumbag, and yes, he was responsible for co-sponsoring certain bills and things of that nature. But you know, it's not like, you know, talk about Hart Celler. Well, Celler was not a WASP, right? And all the different as you mentioned, the Jewish organizations that were lobbying for increased immigration to remove the moratorium to stop the quotas from the traditional sources of American immigration and radically reorient them. Today, I think it's only 17% of all immigrants to America come from Europe and Canada combined. And the majority of those Canadian ones go to Maine. And that's kind of what I was talking about in the Maine immigration aspect. The vast it is very peculiar because Maine gets a much larger than the American percentage of its immigrants from Western sources. However, the refugee resettlement population that they're drawing from for the United States is 51% from sub-Saharan Africa, and it's over 90 for Maine. So it's a kind of like a they're trying to kind of recalibrate or almost overcompensate for this by adding something else into the mix. And as I mentioned, again, the asylum loophole, you could have theoretically, you could have everyone on Earth claim asylum. And while it's taking time to process these claims and think, no one ever shows up for the asylum adjudication or whatever. I didn't even bother following up on what the process is, because for all intents and purposes, when you claim asylum, you're in. So why even bother learning about the procedural shit when no one even follows through on it? So you basically claim asylum and you're in. And, you know, so people are celebrating, oh, Trump's been great about lowering the refugee cap. So what? It doesn't matter if anyone – and I called it the Camp of the Saints moment, those migrant caravans. What did they do? They let them in. And so that's it. The border is gone. There is no southern border. It's dissolved. So
what's the ethnic makeup of the border guards?
I don't know, actually. Isn't that like – I think it's very Hispanic, but – I don't know what the percentage is.
Now, that might be practical, given, you know, the language that's spoken down there. But I'm thinking that's another reason. This is, you know, I mean, ethnic identity and ethnic consciousness has been so pathologized with racism. And who created racism as a sort of a thing?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's, our friends.
Our friends. And but, they, you know, when it comes down to ethnic identity, geez, I mean, they talk about a group, you know, that prides itself on its identity. I guess not for, you know, for thee, not for me. But this is the trick they play, because when you talk about, you know, sovereignty and nation and these things, you know, any, you know, you have a community, a city, a polis, it's going to sort of come down on ethno-religious lines. You know, anything else is you have a Tower of Babel. But at the same time, they've pathologized that sense of community, which is the most stable, enduring, and sustaining, and they've romanticized diversity, you know. And when you mentioned the reality of diversity is exploding welfare rolls, high crime, declining education, and overall decline in the quality of life, lower wages and these things, which serves the interest of the international, you know, corporations, the cosmopolitans. But, you know, here's a good example. You know, Mark Potok, and you probably are familiar with the interview where behind him he had the chart that was sort of charting the a wall, hanging on the wall.
Yes.
Charting
yes.
the decline of the white population. Now, if it doesn't matter, if ideas matter, only ideas, and if you identify with certain American ideals, you're an American, and if ethnicity or race doesn't matter, why is he even charting that?
Yeah, well, that it's irrelevant, right?
It's irrelevant. Then it is, obviously it is relevant. And if the, and we hear talk about changing America, the changing color of a complexion of America, the browning of America, and all of that it portends. You know, there is a law professor from UCLA, I think his name's Adam Winkler, not Henry Winkler, Adam Winkler, not the Fonz, but another Jew playing an Italian. No, but anyway, He wrote a series of articles talking about, I think, one of the elections where I think the candidates endorsed by the National Rifle Association were victorious. And he's making the claim that, you know, although this round the NRA was successful, over the long term they're not going to be because of the changing demographics of the country, the browning of the country. How basically he made the point that, you know, the Second Amendment in particular and the Constitution in general more or less is a white thing. And as the country becomes more ethnically diverse, you know, more brown with particularly Hispanics, growing Asians, people from sub-Africa, if you will. I don't know if there's been talked about at that point. The support for these things are going to decline and the NRA is going to have less political success with its lobbying. Well, that if the country, it does face a qualitative change in its politics because of demographics, then those who want to preserve the Second Amendment or the other aspects of the Constitution have to reverse the demographics, and they're admitting it. You're being gaslighted almost, because they're admitting it to you. They're saying life is going to change because of the demographics. And so then if you want to preserve the Second Amendment of the Constitution, your quality of life, you have to reverse the demographics. But then if you endorse policies that bring that about, you're called a racist.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and there were a few key players, actually, I had neglected to mention. So in the this is sort of circling back to what we said, what we were talking about earlier. I apologize for not a very good transition to this, but it had just popped into my head that. So if you look at the key players who are presently involved, I wanted to highlight a few figures for the listeners. The gentleman, if we can say that, who is responsible for the initial call for the so-called migrants to come up to Maine as the mayor of Portland, would you like to guess whether he goes to Temple or not? So he, the present governor, was married to a Jewish real estate developer. He's passed away, but she has five stepdaughters from this guy, and has so there may be some interest there. And as I mentioned, one of the representatives is, of course, was married to that Donald Sussman. Mm-hmm. We have one of the two representatives is in fact Jewish. The other one represents the, I think, District 2. And one of the major Republican state senators who is pushing for an increase in migrant labor, LD 1490, I think it is. I forget the exact name of the bill that's been proposed, but he's one of these Chamber of Commerce types, Roger Katz, Jew. One of the former mayors of Portland, I think two mayors ago or three mayors ago, James I. Cohen, is a major player in one of the immigration law firms there that is trying to advocate for increased immigration to or migration to the state. And the, you know, these immigration, if people wonder why there are so many law firms involved in this stuff, one, think about who are often lawyers, but secondarily, a huge amount of money made from not just immigration law, but from the facilitation of visas and all this other stuff for corporations. And that's one key factor. I've also noticed a number of law firms keep popping up again and again and again in this thing. And so, like I said, I apologize for a really awful transition there. But
this is what they call, I mean, economically, or do the oligarchs talk about things like the changing geographics of production? And that's how they view the world. And, you know, they're going to use one part of the continent to start producing more. Now, to carry out that policy, they're going to have to create a lot of upheaval and distortions in local economies and foment a war here, create a civil war there, create a crisis here to justify these things. And this is what, evidently, if you look at like North Africa and or Middle East and even Latin America, for the past, you know, 67 years, various banana wars and these things. This is always being done to enrich a few corporations, and the Americans are told this is what must be done to support our way of life. But now perhaps America's on a receiving end of more of this stuff than it was maybe 50, 60 years ago. But if you start pointing out the fact that the commonality of many of the participants in this, what ethnic group they're from, you'll say, well, they're just individuals,
right?
They're all just individuals. You know, again, we'll go back to the individual case, as if there's no collective, organization or agency here, or just a broader worldview. And you have the same situation going on in Europe, I believe. You know, I think it's Barbara Leonard Spector who just said it, admitted it, the Jews are going to be behind the destruction of what remains of the ethnostates in Europe. It has to be done, she said, and we're going to be resented for it. She said that.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw this, but given what's going on in France, Israel just passed some sort of resolution. Well, I don't know, just this was a little while ago, but passed a resolution that France's 200,000 Jews will be fast tracked for visas to exercise their right of return. So now that they've effectively run it into the ground, they can get off like rats from a sinking ship and go to Israel. They have the ultimate ethno state, and they have the internationalist cosmopolitan thing. So they're basically dealing from a side of strength on both sides of the coin. Again, there are ways that you could easily, particularly with Israel, you could easily undercut it. But I don't know that See, I'm very ambivalent about Israel in general, because they do more our Levantine friends do much more damage as a diaspora. So
yeah, that's interesting because remember a lot of the support for Israel in 1940s was the belief that okay, now they have their own state, the question will be answered in a humane way, regardless of what happened to the Palestinians that happened to be there at the time. They were just shunted aside. But the idea was they get their own state and you know they'd stop being a problems in the diaspora countries. That isn't how it's turned out, is it?
Right, yeah, because they refuse to all go back. I mean, yeah. There's probably as many Jews in America as there are in Israel.
Oh, that's very, I mean, have you read, Whitney Webb has had a series, and she was writing about this Unit 8200 and Jeffy Epstein Network, how they get involved in a lot of the high-tech companies. And basically Google, Microsoft, they have Israeli agents on the board or high up in these corporations. And I think it was in your piece, and you read there, was it the comptroller of Maine that has Maine buying Israeli bonds, who's Jewish? Yeah. The same thing in Ohio, by the way.
Of course.
These right? CNMs that they say. So this is interesting how, again, this is using fine. Again, the point, you sound like a paranoid ant, you know, they're out, Jews are out to get us. But the whole point is they, you have these people who are Jewish who identify as Israelis carrying out, you know, using their positions in state governments and corporations to benefit the Israeli state.
Yeah, absolutely.
No.
And it's a little less explicit in Maine to that degree because the sort of overlap isn't quite as extreme. But you're right. You do. There is that connection there. It's more pronounced elsewhere. But there are other little connections and things that they've been able to establish. Not least of which is the fact that there's a gigantic amount of these summer camps that they go to, and a lot of them are in places like New Hampshire and Maine. And that's one aspect I haven't really gotten into much. I think I need to sort of dig into that a bit more and see, does that have an influence on the local? I mean, I'm sure it does on the local culture, particularly since they're in such rural places. But you know, to what degree that is an influence but that aside, you're right. The sort of double dealing with the Israel aspect, a lot of these companies too have board members who have military experience and also have connections to Israel, and all these other things. And I've encountered a few companies where I've looked at and I'm like, a lot of these people on the board don't really even have business experience.
No, it's military or intelligence. 8200 gets in that Promise Software story, which again, not enough people are aware of, but you know, basically it's backdoor technology and into all of our communication systems, even governmental, and this gets into like what happened in 9/11 perhaps, but the idea again, Benjamin Netanyahu would talk about how Israeli is leading the way in innovative technology and cybersecurity and telecommunications and all that stuff. Well, this is a foreign government, and these companies are parastatal, meaning they are a part of the Israeli state. Same with Silicon Valley here, really. But the point is that, Sergey Brin Sergey Brin. So a lot of these very large corporations that the products we use are familiar with, they're infested with Israeli agents.
Yeah. And there definitely is a connection. And you do see that with the state of Maine or people who have been in the public or private sector there, and they kind of circle between, you know, there's that whole network of, you know, you're on the board of directors here on this thing and this company and this charity. And then, you know, it's again, there's a ton of interconnectedness, and the larger and more, you know, the more omnipresent the system grows, the more that'll become explicit as they squeeze people out. And it's already pretty damn omnipresent. You know, you might even say that it is almost fully omnipresent. You really can't escape this stuff to a large degree. But, you know, all those things considered, you know, I think that one of the key takeaways is, as I said a little earlier, a lot of it is built on very shaky ground, and a lot of it is created kind of, it has like an illusory nature. So a lot of the power is not hard power, which is to their benefit, at least temporarily, because they can exercise that soft power. It's not anything. It's anything but soft if someone's come down on the receiving end of some of this stuff. But through the privatized stuff, the terms of service and all these other things, well, and the ability to exert social pressure.
Yeah, it seems almost natural, if not natural, but uncoordinated and just happening. You know, right. If they came with an invading army and started raping our women, that would inspire resistance, I hope.
Yeah.
But if they do it like in Germany, and they publish pamphlets, the health agent department there publishes pamphlets, demonstrating how German women can have sex with brown men, or they promote media in these things, so these things, the culture, this thing, or they just one day you wake up in the course of 5 years, your community that was once 5% Hispanic is now 50% Hispanic. And there's no work to be had anymore. And these things, how do you fight that? But you have to identify the agency, right? You have to, this is how they're doing this. And there are NGOs, organizations that have connections to various foreign governments, usually just, like Israel or U.S. government. There's agendas being carried out through the U.S. government, through these NGOs that were empowered by a law passed in 1980 to carry out this displacement that we're seeing today. And if you read your articles, you see kind of laid out before. Just like if you read those books that I mentioned, Slaughter of Cities or John Carter Cole and the Cultural Revolution, there's a history to this stuff, and there's a paper trail. It's not a fantasy. It's not a paranoid fantasy or delusion. There are organizations and corporations and groups that have stand to benefit from this through the enslavement and the immiseration of humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And they'll sell your own misery back to you. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's all there. I mean, a lot of it is very difficult, as I mentioned, to track down. But if you are willing to take the time to do that, and like I said, I'm hoping with this exercise that I've provided a rough framework so people can see the types of organizations that will donate to other types of organizations and what types of organizations are principal actors in certain things and who's funding this, that, and the other thing. And it's the ability to be able to do that then and start tracking down all of these connections, I think is essential. So,
it's very similar to like what they did with urban renewal and integration in the 60s.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The pretext of these things. And when I was reading those pieces, this is very similar to the program that was carried out and using NGOs or organizations like the Quakers or the Catholic Interracial Council or civil rights organizations and these things appealing to, more or less appealing to everyone's, emotion or heartstrings, sometimes exploiting, legitimate grievances, but weaponizing them for an agenda.
Yeah, I think Chateau Hartiste called it empathy obesity. Like the idea is everyone's been so... like our discourse is so effete and sentimentalized, they can easily do that. And it's like, well, here's this one, it's like the so-called migrant crisis in Europe. Here's this one drowned kid who died as a result of atrocious parenting. Mm-hmm. But somehow this is your fault and you better take 6 million or whatever the number is, that's the first one that popped into my mind, but
it's a nice number round figure.
Yeah, it is. So, totally. And so you better take these people. And it's like somehow your fault that someone half a world away decided to put his kid on a leaky raft and try to cross a sea. I mean, come on.
I think the key point here is that people have to identify that there is high level malevolence.
Oh, big time.
An organization behind this. If the word conspiracy bothers you, this is being carried out, and you can see, whether it's to lower wages or to change the demographics so you lower wages so you don't have to deal with unions anymore, you don't have to deal with cohesive communities that have identity that can fight back against the cultural agenda. It just opens up societies in these things, and it's the same way that you soften a country up with whether it's an embargo or bombing. This is how you soften up the first world. For some reason, I think at this stage, Western white cultures are being particularly targeted because perhaps they represent a bigger threat to the global elite. I mean, there's more opposition to come from that. And once you knock them down, then they can target the other groups.
You know? Yeah, I think so. And then once you're able to take, you're able to sort of transition one population to oblivion while bringing in another one so they can learn to become, quote, westernized as you kind of phase out the other one. But there's enough infrastructure. Again, it will inevitably decay. It's Paul Kersey's Detroit corollary to social cohesion. You know, eventually it will regress to the mean and it will fall apart. But again, then you've got your little Nestle there to take advantage of it and make some good money. And I think Nestle is, I want to say their sales of bottled water, it's billions. It's gotta be billions of dollars. I'm sure. In fact. And, you know, so then you have this kind of, you know, the privatization, the corporatization, and, you know, the one aspect I didn't really get into too much of the refugee resettlement thing is in Canada, they have a kind of like this loophole where basically private individuals and or corporations can sponsor refugees to come in, which go over and above whatever the official governmental cap is. And this is the latest thing they're pushing for. So in addition to the, you know, I call it the Hotel California thing, where basically you can say, well, I'm out of the refugee resettlement program. Say, well, you're not so fast. There's this other aspect to it that has been tried out in Canada, and a few other countries are starting, Western countries are starting to experiment with it as well. So there really is the move to fully privatize everything eventually and then just dispense with the state altogether.
Yeah, which is the ultimate, I think, goal of these international corporations.
Yeah, yeah, just run it. The borderless world, who, again, was it qui bono? That's, you know. Who's benefiting? Well, certainly not the people of Germany. They, you know, they'll say it's enriching and such out of one corner of their mouths. Well, at the other corner of their mouth, it's all, well, the Holocaust and white guilt and everything else. But who's really benefiting? I mean, it is a combination of extreme greed and the profit motive with racial and ethno-religious animus. I mean, if you don't understand the Jewish question and neoliberal capitalism, that's why the world doesn't make sense to you. I mean, that you have to understand those two things, and everything becomes very clear very quickly.
And the 20th century was key to that. It's been called the Jewish century.
Makes sense. Yeah,
I think it was Susskind wrote a book called it the Jewish century, and that's when I think the ability of Christian, you know, the Western Christian societies to enunciate or articulate opposition or an argument to Jewish power was destroyed because of the Second World War. It actually was an enthronement of Jewish power. And yeah, in the West, in the United States, you had the WASP elite and these things, but that went into decline in the 60s. And since 67, you had Jewish ascendancy in the United States here. And you see it in the media. And ironically, you know, now you see just more and more films about World War II as that event becomes further removed, right? I mean, if you look at the historiography of some of these events, you saw the same thing in the 60s in the Civil War, in the Civil Rights Movement, the treatment of the so-called American Civil War, where the historiography of the 60s served contemporary political interests. That was sort of advancing the cult of integration, civil rights, and sort of the further consolidation of the American state under the guise of civil rights and these things, the so-called revolution. The same thing in the Second World War, whereas if you look at how most people viewed the war in the 50s and 60s, even in movies, there's very little, no treatment of the so-called Holocaust. It wasn't even called that. That term came about in the 1970s. It was if you look at war movies, you know, just more of it's about German generals and soldiering, and very little about, you know, about the Shoah, as they called it then. But as you get further in, since the late 70s, you know, it just became a myth that was stoked and created. Now you have museums popping up like mushrooms. And in elementary schools, you've classes now or part of the curriculum, Holocaust education. This isn't an American event. You know, I mean, when I was like in the eighth grade in U.S. history or world history, you came across it as you were studying World War II. Now they want specific classes for it.
Oh, yeah.
These events, you know, again, the interpretation of the historical events serve contemporary political interests. In the 60s, all of a sudden, the Civil War is all about slavery, right? you know, so the racial issue. And with the ascendancy of, you know, Jewish ascendancy in America in the 70s, Holocaust, because the Holocaust, disarms any opposition, because the Jews being history's victims, you can't criticize them as a group, because any criticism as a group leads to the Holocaust. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep, that's and we've seen this recently with the whole preposterous notion that the detainment camps at the border are somehow concentration camps, and it's like they're trying to meme that into reality. It's insane. But you see these things, and I reference one article, I think from the, I don't know, one of their publications, and they're basically, it was like 1,400 religious leaders co-signed a letter of, you know, abolish the detention camps because it's another Shoah. And you see it again and again and again. Yep. And you like, really? Like, we get it, but...
Well, this is how you create a meme, and a meme becomes a belief, a myth. And this is what's happened. I mean, I don't want to open up that can of worms, but it's Andrew Joyce had a piece a while back talking about the pogroms in Russia, how these were, again, a product of wild exaggeration and myth. And basically, your Jews, the, you know, explosion of the population in this area, they left for particularly economic reasons. But to create the justification for the immigration, they created these stories exaggerating, in many cases, or just making up to justify. And then many Jews came to believe it themselves, which sort of animated or motivated their antipathy towards Russia in the early 20th century, which led to the revolution, to Jacob Schiff. And these people were, they were descendants from this. But the whole idea is the whole idea of exaggerating, you know, an atrocity, these atrocity stories, to justify, to gain power, or to prevent any criticism of a policy that you may want to see carried out. But it's my question is, if I question the Russian pogroms, will I go to jail if I live in Germany?
I mean, probably.
Is there a law against questioning the pogroms in Russia yet?
Probably. So, I would imagine. I wouldn't even be surprised. But yeah, it's like one of those things where, it's been used repeatedly as a battering ram, mm-hmm. to just say, to take people's defenses down, and if the population is sufficiently sentimentalized, then they will respond to that and go, oh my goodness. And it relies on a lot of historical ignorance, but you're right. Even a lot of, you know, Jews themselves believe that these things happen when they surely have been wildly exaggerated. I mean, I would not be surprised if there were instances, for example, I was doing some research into the Jews in England before they were kicked out, and there were instances where they were, again, getting people in debt, even credible rumors of child sacrifice and stuff, which is another thing people, you know, they're like, oh, you know, in the ignorant Middle Ages and stuff. And it's like, well, there's actually some fairly credible evidence that this stuff went on. And so then they want to expel the people out of their community for obvious reasons, because why would you want someone who's abducting kids and ripping you off and charging usurious interest and all that other stuff? Why would you want that in your why would anyone want that in their community? And so, I mean, there were occasional massacres and things of that nature, but the degree and the severity is very much exaggerated. I mean, there was one, I think it was 1190 in York, England. There was one. But what happened is the Jews there, obviously they, I don't want to say they brought it on themselves, but they kind of did. But not only that, but they holed up in a watchtower, and it wouldn't let the constable or whoever it was that was in charge back into the building. And then they started chucking rocks at the people who were outside. And it's like, okay, well, you know, of course they're not going to accept any culpability for taking the incident and amplifying it and turning it into, full-fledged battle. And they ended up, I think they actually, I don't know that they were masked. I think for the most part, they ended up killing themselves because I think they realized they were going to be killed if they left.
Like a mini Masada?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that the situation was totally of their creation. in the first place. But again, accepting culpability for any of those things is, you know, not part of what they do.
Yeah, and then you have, you know, of course, in history where Jews themselves have played a significant part in slaughters, like the Ukrainian famine.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas 9 out of 10 commissars were Jewish, and there was, you know, Kaganovich, the people that carried these things out in Ukraine were Jewish. But there was an instance where Abe Foxman went to Ukraine, and they were having a dialogue with him regarding about, and the Ukrainian government was talking about what happened. And this factors into the politics, you know, Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. There's a lot of getting into the ethnic dispute there between, you know, half of Ukraine identifies with Russia, half with, you know, with Western. And of course, the West is there exploiting that to go after Putin's Russia and these things. But there's a reason why when the Germans went into Ukraine that many of the Ukrainians signed up with the SS, you know, and that was something called the 1930s and the Holodomor. But I guess they're talking at a table that's on film, and then Abe Foxman sort of lectures the Ukrainian official to be careful to draw comparisons between the Ukrainian Holodomor and the Holocaust. Be very, very careful, you know. And, of course, the irony is that Jews themselves in the NKVD were overwhelmingly responsible for carrying that policy out. But they accept no responsibility for this, you know.
No, of course not.
You know. But the entire Western world now is guilt-ridden because of the so-called Holocaust, and that's demonstrated in the fact that every city, there has to be a monument or a museum to that. And recently, Ireland was being lectured for not having a Holocaust museum. And it's like, well, does Israel have a monument to the potato, to the so-called potato famine? Carried out by British. Yes. You know, this really wasn't a famine. It was British starvation policy. But I was like, no, they don't do that. That's not the thing, because if you see what's going on in Ireland now, it's now being conquered, you know.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, and that's happening very quickly. Yeah. And when I was on JF's show, I mentioned this. It's almost exclusively because of the fact that Ireland decided to open itself up to all these companies starting in the 90s with the Celtic Tiger and all that other stuff. And now, look what you get. You know,
there was the boom to change the culture, then the bust, pump and dump. And now they changed they corrupted the culture with Global Homo. And then they're able to get this, you know, these constitution changed to legalize abortion, gay marriage and these things. And then they start pumping in the North African people from sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, and Ireland of all places. Again, yeah, another natural destination,
like a gay for Indian guy, right?
Yeah, the president's a gay Indian. I think of Ireland, I think Catholic and fair skin, red and blonde hair. I'm sorry.
Right, exactly. You know. But you're right. You can see how powerful their tactics are, though, because if there was one country in Western Europe that you would have put your money on to resist, that would have been it.
Yes. And they did it through referendum. In the West, in the Eastern United States, they've had to – largely a lot of the culture has been waged through bureaucracy and the courts and the media. It's not popular sovereignty. One of the biggest problems we have here is the sort of the in America, we have the illusion of popular sovereignty and democracy in elections, but the reality is oligarchic rule through control of the media and these things. And that's the biggest, I think, political problem we have here. It's starting to break apart now, I think. There's greater consciousness now of this because of things they create, like the internet, which they're trying to rein in now. So, you know, it's, you know, again, but your website goes a long way in addressing these things, the anatomically correct banana.
Yes. I went with something memorable because, you know, there's a lot of good names out there and stuff. And I'm like, all right, well, I want to, if I'm going to carve out a niche for myself, you know, how am I going to do that? So let me just think of something really ridiculous.
It's a great way. I've been reading through the articles, the people, not only your pieces, but the people that contribute in there. Because not only, I mean, today we talked about this series that you ran about weaponized migration. But there is a book called Weapons of Mass Migration by Kelly Greenhill.
Okay,
written in 2010. It's sort of a cold treatment of this policy, how historically this has been policies for various reasons. It's not like a critical analysis. It's just laying out this is often used throughout history by various groups against other groups. So this is nothing new. And there is the Caligari plan, right? We're not making this up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it comes out of nowhere.
I mean, and this very thing he endorsed, and he himself was interested. I think he was part Japanese, married to a Jewish lady. And so he himself had mixed ethnicity, so it goes to his loyalty. But he was ultimately funded by the Warburgs, the Jewish banking family.
Ah, yes, yes. That's surprising. Mm-hmm.
But this art, but again, what you do in the series on Maine, you concentrate on Maine, because Maine is like, wasn't Maine like just run up to this influx of migrants or immigrants called too white by some people?
Yeah, and that's another thing. Maine and New Hampshire, all of a sudden, quote unquote, were having pieces published in the New York Times saying, oh, they're too old, they're too white, Washington Post, you know, all the usual suspects. And lo and behold, what do you get, right? And it's like this coordinated attack all of a sudden mm-hmm. on these last bastions that were basically untouched by all this stuff. And, you know, it's, you know, like I said, I just something stuck out to me about it being very bizarre. And I, you know, I'm aware of all the things that they do, and I, but, you know, you see something doesn't pass the smell test. And for whatever reason, I decided, you know, I'm going to pursue this one and yeah. this one particular case study. But I think it's important to do that, to understand. I mean, you have to understand broadly what they're doing, mm-hmm. but also to look at it on a, you know, it would be much, and in some ways it would be much harder for me to look at what their efforts and say like, and they're doing it everywhere, like Virginia, Georgia, every mm-hmm. pick a state.
Yeah.
But it's a relatively small state. And as I mentioned, there is such a low percentage of Jews, it makes it really stand out. So you can, it's easier to discern this stuff, despite, as I mentioned, it is extremely time consuming and often tedious and difficult. But imagine if you were trying to do it to like California, like how much more you'd have to, you know, you'd have to wade through. So for me, it's a good microcosm. And you can see how it in many ways is a relic of the era before multiculturalism. You know, to some degree, there's some, you know, French Acadian influence there, but for the most part, it's white Anglo-Saxon Protestant yeah. founding stock.
Did the same articles in the Washington Post bemoaning that it was too white also claim that the crime rate was too low?
I don't believe so, but it's a point I've made a few times. It is, it does have, I don't know if it still does, but it did have the lowest crime rate in the country.
Well, got to change that. Got to spice things up a little bit.
Well, of course. Yeah. And I one of the main cities in Maine that's been targeted is Lewiston. And, you know, Jared Howe has very extensively covered what's gone on there, but the Somalis who have been relocated there are almost exclusively responsible for all of the crime. It's, you know, they're virtually unheard of, you know, homicides and stuff. And now all of a sudden they're beating a guy to death with a brick in Kennedy Park. And of course, when the current governor was attorney general, she basically held up the investigation until she could successfully become the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've been able to identify some of the culprits. And one of them was I think he's 17. They want to try him as an adult. But, you know, there have been other instances where she's declined to prosecute. And she did a lot of, a lot of manipulation of the legal system to obscure the fact that this population has been causing serious problems.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see that video? This was in, I think, in Minnesota, of the Chipotle.
I did.
The Somali gang. Now, they've been very Americanized, and, you know, they were second generation, I imagine. But, you know, where they come in, they do dash and dine, where they order the food and they run out. And, of course, the way Chipotle has set up, you make your order and you pay as you leave. And this is a very convenient setup. Of course, this type of setup requires high trust. And these are the type of businesses that go. You lose this convenience when you start having high crime. These are the type of operations you don't see in high crime areas because of this thing. So they, you know, so now, you know, this first went viral because this young man, Somalian American, claimed he had been discriminated against. Well, in a sense, he was. But then why shouldn't he be? And the where he complains, hey, that white dude didn't have to pay this, like, this, you know, 50-ish old guy. And the lady behind the counter, who's Hispanic, by the way, from what I could make out, goes, well, he pays and you don't.
Right.
Because she's not riddled with white guilt. They fire her.
Oh, my God.
Then they hired her back because it turns out this guy and his gang had posted on social media how they go about and do this stuff all the time. They rob places.
Yeah, but that's a high IQ at work there. Admit to it on social media.
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, exactly. Another thing, these aren't the brightest people. But again, it's a lumpen proletariat that the international cosmopolitan business interests can use to, disrupt a community, lower wages, and, without any thought. Again, this whole demand for lower wages is there's no consideration for the effect it has on the community because these business interests, they don't have any loyalty to a given area or locale or anything. The rich have no loyalty. That's the problem.
Right. They don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they are rootless cosmopolitans. I mean, they really are. They don't care. They're not bound to these things. They don't care about it. And they're ensconced in their gated communities and everything anyway, so they don't have to deal with the fallout.
Well, that's the worst thing is that the poorer you are, or the more lower middle class you are, you can't escape it. If you're upper middle class or wealthy, you can escape it. And then you can preen yourself and think, I'm not a racist. I don't care about these things. I believe I'm colorblind. I'm colorblind in my gated community.
Yeah. It's like this idiot Tim Wise that you're always seeing on Twitter. I think his hometown is like 97% white or something. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, dude, if it's, why don't you... What's the deal then? Why don't you want to live in a more diverse community? What's going on there, Chief?
Yeah. Well, that's the worst thing about it is people that talk about these things are accused of being racist because they're being blunt and open about it. They're acknowledging social realities or truths, hard truths. But the people that still sort of, I guess they want to pass off or virtue signal as, baby boomer type, colorblind. If they can afford it, they live in the most segregated communities around. They escape with their money.
Oh yeah, totally.
They don't have to deal with it for the time being. By the way, for the time being.
Yeah, for now. I mean, yeah. It will come eventually. I mean, look at South Africa, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's only a matter of time, but by then, the parasitic influence will just have jumped onto, another host.
Mm-hmm. And interesting to point out, South Africa's demographics in the latter half of the 20th century was brought about by business interests flooding the area with cheap labor. That's the true history of South Africa. It's people, Americans thought of it as sort of an analog to the American Civil Rights Movement. And in the 1980s, I don't know if you're old enough to remember that if you were a liberal, you had to get arrested outside the South African embassy. that was
the rite of passage.
Rite of passage. But the what happened there, this whole idea of dispossessing black, the Afrikaners kind of carved out that civilization, made it productive, and then in the 19th century, the Rothschild, Cecil Rhodes bank interest came in and flooded it with cheap labor, and that's how you got the situation you had, after 1948. In there,
yeah, I've read a lot about that in Kerry Bolton's stuff, where mm-hmm. he's talking about apartheid is. Either in the American South or South Africa or Rhodesia or wherever, Australia has been, it's inherently a giant barrier to neoliberalism. So
yes,
it must be attacked. Mm-hmm. And they'll use the sort of equality thing, which, to a degree, they're not wrong. But if you see in practicality what ends up happening is the living standard for everybody goes to shit.
Yeah.
And there's a way to do this where you're not oppressing people and exploiting people, but that's not it.
Yeah. You don't
scrap the nation for parts. And
well, ultimately, they didn't want a strong South African state with a gold backed currency. So you destroy it under the guise of racial equality, and you can steal everything eventually, which what they're doing now, as you point out, with the freedom, with this with Malema being a proxy for this Jewish gangster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's not as, not as, it's not the moral fairy tale that we're given to believe. And there's some, you know, hard reality to this world. And you have to kind of carve out an area, defend it, and defend your interest. And a large part of that is having a distinct, a concrete real identity. And that usually breaks down to some sort of ethno-religious thing.
Yeah.
But in modern America, liberal America, pluralistic America, that's racism.
And... right. If you look like us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, listen, I've had you a long time. I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, I want to thank you for the invite.
Oh,
so.
And of course, your website is the Anatomically Correct Banana, right? That's how you...
That's right. The anatomicallycorrectbanana.com. And the Cocktail Hour is my podcast.
Yeah, I highly recommend that. Again,
thank you.
That kind of goes kind of like this conversation usually, right? That's what I've gathered.
The show. Yeah, exactly. Like just kind of chatting, and you know, much more laid back. But I like that format because you tend to cover a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. That you might not get to if you don't let the natural flow of conversation go where it needs to, you know?
Yeah. And of course you're on what, the Third Rare, which is carried on The Right Stuff, right?
Yeah. I'm on the third. I would say describe myself as a regular. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been on a host of other podcast appearances and such. And, I also have a few pieces if people are curious to read on Arctos as well.
Oh yeah. I've interviewed John Bruce Leonard. He's interviewed me a couple of times.
That is one smart guy.
Yeah. I'm probably going to reach out to him when I get a chance to read his book. He wrote a book. I'm going to see if he'll come back on, and that should be a good interview. But a lot of good stuff there, because then a lot of the stuff we're talking about, you know, the right left thing doesn't fit into it, does it? Because right and left are being manipulated.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess I say that I'm part of the dissident right. I mean, economically, I'm pretty much a lefty. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things that don't neatly fit into this paradigm anymore, and we're still trying to define these new terms and define our place in this changing reality. But the thing is, the old era, whatever era, let's call it, you know, the modern era or whatnot, is coming to a close and a new one is dawning. Mm-hmm. And we need people might complain that things are falling apart, and they are, and things are going to be very ugly. But by the same token, we're uniquely positioned to help shape the future of our civilization, not just save it, but set it up for, you know, long-term flourishing. So, I wouldn't have it any other way in that sense.
So it's, you know, I guess civilization won't be saved with marginal tax cuts and healthcare reform, right?
Right. Not by my estimation, anyway. Maybe another mass amnesty, though.
Yeah, yeah, another, yeah, yeah. Thank you, Ronald Reagan, for that. Yep, yep. So, okay, well, I'll let you go. Let's enjoy the rest, what remains of your weekend. I'll post this soon, and what I'll do, I'll send you the link, so.
Okay, and I will plug it and promote it.
Great. Take care then.
All right. See you later. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.